As usual, our singing in the hours of worship are an integral part of our being here. Your participation is very, very important, and it's encouraging. And I want to make mention of it as often as is appropriate, and probably more often than is appropriate, maybe, but not more often than I appreciate it. It's an encouragement to me, and I want to be an encouragement to you. We've had a good day. Have you enjoyed playing in the snow? I have. I threw a $25 snowball today. I hope it's just $25. It may be a $50 one. I feel like the man they were getting ready to hang, and they asked him, "Do you have anything else you want to say?" And he said, "Yes, I sure have learned my lesson." I threw a snowball today and hit somebody in the head, and they lost their contact lens. Well, it's not funny. We're going to take up a collection in a minute. Oh, it's a pleasure being with you. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers at their business. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all with the sheep and the oxen out of the temple, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things out of here. You shall not make my Father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for thy house will consume me." The Jews then said to him, "What sign have you to show us for doing this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews said then, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he spoke of the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. The two verses, or the one verse preceding the beginning of this reading, tells us that Jesus and his mother and his brothers and these six disciples that he had gathered around him, they went from Cana down to Capernaum. The little towns over there are often called Kaphar, K-A-P-H-R, I think, which means town, the town of Nahum. And that town dates way on back, perhaps, to the time of Nahum. But the town of Nahum, Capernaum. And they went down there for some reason or other. It says they didn't stay long. They stayed only for a few days. But nevertheless, they went there. I don't know why. We know later on, and shortly after this, really, they moved. Jesus and his mother, probably also, and his brothers, the whole family, moved to Capernaum. And maybe they were down there, I don't know, looking for a house. They didn't move too much longer after this. We don't know why they went, and there's no use speculating, but the house that they did move in eventually there had to be repaired. We know that because the four friends of the paralytic, they tore up the roof of Jesus' own house here in Capernaum. He had to get somebody in there, I guess, to repair it. But so many things that are interesting that we see in his life that touch on the everyday that we are aware of and that touch on our everyday life. It may have been that he went by there just to get with some friends to go on up to the Passover. These people traveled in groups, I think probably for protection as much as anything else, protection from robbers. And it may be that they did like we do. They said, "We'll be by to pick you up on, you know, at 10 o'clock on Thursday, and we'll all go together. When we go to ball games or homecomings, we do that, and we enjoy the company." And they did that, too. It was a good long 3 days' journey, you see, from Capernaum up to Jerusalem, if you were walking. And so he went by, anyway, to Capernaum, and it says the Passover of the Jews was at hand. And they went on up to Jerusalem to be a part of that Passover feast. You know, the Passover was the most important feast of the Jewish year. The Jewish calendar year had no more important event than that. It was their homecoming, you might say. And people from all over the world came to the Jewish homecoming, the Passover feast. The Passover usually fell, it always fell on the 15th of Nisan, but it always varied anywhere from about the last week of March on through, sometimes maybe as late as the last of April, but around the middle of April was this feast. Every year, it was during the springtime, and everything is beautiful and in color and bloom, and it was just a beautiful time of year. And they'd go up there, and they'd meet old friends and relatives and see people they hadn't seen in a year, maybe they hadn't seen in 5 or 10 years. And aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces and all would get together, and they'd say, "I'll meet you over at so-and-so's place, you know, at the restaurant there, and we'll have dinner together." You can just imagine all the things that happened during this wonderful time of the year, the Feast of the Passover. The Feast of the Passover was such an enormous thing that I can't really grasp it. Josephus says that at the time of the keeping of the feast by Jesus, at the time of his life, that between 2 and 2.5 million pilgrims came to Jerusalem on that day, or for that week's activities. And it lasted a week. It was their homecoming week. But 2 to 2.5 million people, can you imagine it, swelling that little city of Jerusalem? I don't see how they all got in there. In fact, they didn't all get in there. They must have done what we do on our homecoming weeks, or our homecoming days. The little towns surrounding Jerusalem must have absorbed the overflow. They must have gone down to Bethany and up to Ramallah and those places around there that were there. The Ramallah wasn't there, but the places near there was where the Samaritan. Maybe they stayed in Samaria. You know, I don't guess they would have stayed in Samaria. That wouldn't work. Not any of the Jews would stay there. But anyway, the surrounding towns had to absorb the overflow. And so they came there from all over the world, not just from Galilee and not just from Jerusalem or Judea. They were there from all over the whole Mediterranean world. Parthians and Medes and Elamites and the dwellers of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia and Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya about Cyrene, sojourners from Rome, Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians, they all were there at this tremendous feast. And when you think about the preparation that had to be made, and when you think about the enormity of the occasion that would accommodate between 2.5 and 3 million people, now that's a lot of folks. And yet that's what finally was the population during those hours or during those weeks or those days of the Passover feast. And it spread many times into weeks because the people would come for the Passover feast and they'd just stay the next month and a half until the Pentecost. And they'd get the next feast too. And that's what happened in Acts 2. These people would come there for the Passover and stay for the Pentecost. Well, the sheer magnitude of the feast and the extent of the preparations does defy the imagination. For that many people, there would have to be hundreds of thousands of sheep killed for the Passover. In fact, Josephus says that the year that Jesus was crucified, that year there were 256,500 lambs killed that year for the Passover feast. You think about that many sheep. 256,500. I don't know whether I can even accept that figure or not. That just seems beyond my imagination. But anyway, that's just the lambs. That's just the sheep. There were doves. There were oxen. There were other things that were there for animal sacrifices in that tremendous feast of the Passover. And it is this and this kind of a market, and it's this kind of a sale that was going on there in the temple precincts. And you can imagine all the confusion, all the lowing of the cattle and the bleating of the sheep and the doves cooing and fluttering and flying and the droppings of the cattle on the precinct floor and the dust and the smell and the stench and all the confusion of people bartering and trading and carrying on and maybe auctioneering and changing money from one to the other. What a mess. But added to that was the robbery that went with it, the exploitation, the commercialization, and the cheapening that had gone into and that was the result of the commercializing of this sale, the commercializing of the feast that was caused by the sale of these things in the temple precinct. For example, the robbery that accompanied it can be illustrated by this. Outside the temple precinct, you could go into the city of Jerusalem, into the old city, the marketplace there, and buy a pair of turtle doves for 25 cents. If you went and bought them in the temple precinct from the priests, you'd pay $1.80 a pair. Well, why did the people go into the temple to buy? Why didn't they buy out there? Because of the simple fact that the priests who had to inspect the doves and who had to inspect the sheep, they wouldn't put their stamp of approval on the sheep that they didn't sell. they wouldn't put their stamp of approval on the doves that they didn't sell. So you see, they had the people caught. Oh, they could have brought their doves and their sheep with them, and maybe they didn't fool with the doves. I don't have any record there. But I do know from reading in history that they wouldn't allow the sheep to be sacrificed unless they went through their inspection station, like driving your car into an inspection station. They had you. They were the ones that they either gave you the sticker or they didn't give you the sticker. And if you brought a sheep with you from 50 miles away, all the trouble that it took to bring him, and then you stood a very good chance of them not passing that, of their rejecting it. And so there you were, stuck with a sheep. What are you going to do with him? And yet, that's what happened. That's the way things went at that time. So this was what confronted Jesus as he went into the temple. As he looked into and walked into his Father's house, the temple, he saw all of this confusion. He saw all of the exploitation. He saw all the robbing of the poor. He saw all the commercialization and all this that went with it taking place in his Father's house. And so he just decided, by the way, it's time to clean house. And he got a whip made of cords. He went and, I don't know where the cords came from. You might speculate a bit. It may be that every time they killed one of the sheep, they'd cut the cord off of him that he had been brought there with, or he had had more or less of a leash on him perhaps and been brought to the priest, and they snipped those things, laid him on the altar, sacrificed him, and these cords were lying around there in the temple area. Perhaps that's where it came from. But nevertheless, you can almost see him as he picks up those things, and even without even noticing what he's doing, he's watching what's happening, and without noticing the cord, or without even watching or having to watch it, he makes this thing just almost by second nature as he watches, and as the anger and the righteous indignation begins to build up in his eyes. And then he takes that thing by the butt of the whip, and can you imagine the surprise whenever this man comes and the Christ comes with a whip in his hand? Somebody said it must have been a terrifying, awesome spectacle to see the Christ with a whip in his hand. And yet that's what they were confronted with. And you can just imagine the wild mess and the wild party, if you want to call it a party, the disruption of a party, that happened whenever Jesus came in with the whip in his hand. And when Jesus came with a whip in his hand, it was not, he didn't betray that with another look in his eye. He didn't go contrary to what was in his hand with his voice. What was in his hand was in his voice and was in his eye. He didn't make that whip and then go say, "Now, honey, you all go on, get out of here. Don't clutter up the place. You're making too much noise. Run on." Mm-mm. When Jesus made a whip, the whip was in his eye also. The whip was in his voice. The whip was in his tongue. And he took that whip and lo and behold began to knock over. It says he poured out the money changers' money. But that didn't satisfy him. He took their tables and flipped the tables. And the tables went harum scarum, and here they went. And the surprised money changers, you can just see them as they began to run and scurry after their money. And it was rolling, you know, under other tables and rolling under in some of the cattle pens. And people were scurrying after that money and arguing over, "That's mine," you know. And here they were, and this whole confusion set in. And here came this man swinging this whip, and the people were dodging, you know, not get hit from it. And the people that were attending the cattle, here they ran after these cattle. They must have stampeded. When one of them shied away, it must have caused many of them to shy. The sheep, you know, sheep are terribly nervous. They just must have burst loose. And here went the whole mess of them out the gate, out the temple, perhaps over the brook Kidron, over into the Mount of Olives. You just can't ever tell what happened. It's just, but you can visualize in your eye, in your mind's eye, and see the confusion that must have erupted when this Galilean, this young rabbi, came in there with this whip and absolutely drove these people out and said, "Get out of here. You're not going to turn my Father's house into a house of trade." And there he went. Did he ever clean house? Now, that's the story. What is the purpose of John recording it here? Well, in this, we see the flip side of the divine nature. We see another side of him that we don't usually see in the Gospels. In fact, we see a side of him that we don't really take much account of. We tried to find some songs tonight that would accompany this message about the cleaning of the temple. And you know what? There aren't any songs in the book that depict Jesus Christ with a whip in his hand. Never. We just don't really like to remember him like that. And yet, this is the man. This is part of his personality. We see him usually meek and lowly. We see him loving and kind. And that's the way we like to see him. And sure enough, that's the way he is in a primary sense. And yet there's another part of him, though it doesn't contradict that side of him, it does complement that side of him. And if we ignore that which we're talking about tonight, then we get a one-sided picture of him. This man was capable of becoming righteously indignant about certain abuses. Jesus did pity more often than he punished, yes. In fact, he said, "Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest." We like to think about that. We like to think about it as John describes him when he says that God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. And we like to think about Jesus' statement in John's gospel when he said, "I didn't come to condemn the world, I came to save the world." And we like to think about those times, especially say in Matthew 12, in verse 7, where Jesus said, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice." And then he says, "If you had known what this meant, you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless. So this is the side of him that we really like to think about. And yet here's another side of him. Here's another part of his personality. You see, Jesus, and in this passage here, the next verse says, after this is told about him, it says that he knew what was in all men. He knew what was in people. Consequently, when he saw what was in these people, he erupted in this show of righteous indignation that, by the way, we're going to have to take record. We're going to have to take cognizance of. We're going to have to become aware of what he's doing here. We're going to have to reckon with it. And what was he saying? And what was he showing us? In many references, we find his words being very harsh. We find records of him, for example, in Mark, where the man who had the withered hand, and they watched on the Sabbath day in the synagogue to see whether or not he would heal this man that had the withered hand. And he looked around upon them and said, "Tell me, is it right to do good on the Sabbath day or to do harm? Is it right to take a life or to save a life?" And it says they wouldn't answer him. They were silent. And it says, looking around on them with anger, he said to the man, "Reach out your hand," or "stretch it out." And he stretched it out, and it was healed like the other. But it says he looked upon them with anger. There's some verses, or there's some statements that I want to notice just very briefly in passing. In Matthew, the 23rd chapter, from which, incidentally, we're going to be taking some thoughts in just a moment, Jesus uses some language there that's absolutely scathing. Listen to it. He calls them hypocrites, blind fools, blind guides, whitewashed tombs, serpents, brood of vipers. How will you escape the judgment of hell? Then in Matthew 22 and verse 29, just before that, he simply says to the people point blank, "You are wrong. You are ignorant of the scriptures. You are ignorant of the power of God." And then in John chapter 8, verses 44 and 55, he says, "You are sons of the devil. You are liars." Now look, you don't get any more point blank than that. You don't get any more scathing than that. I don't think there's any language in human language that is recorded of people who were civilized people, people who were in charge of things. You don't find any more scathing language than this. Liars, you're devils, you are wrong, you're ignorant of the scriptures, you're ignorant of the power of God. How shall you escape the judgment of hell? You brood of vipers, you serpents, you whitewashed tombs, you blind guides, you blind fools, you hypocrites. Now that's the Lord talking. That's right. But you know what? You still don't know him. Oh, we see these things. Yeah, but you don't know him. You don't know what this implies. Neither do I until I know something else. This is one factor. But it's an unknown factor until you see it related to something else. Because you don't know what he was mad at. We get mad. We've said some things probably as harsh as that. You dummy. You know, you ignorant boob. What's the matter with you? You hypocrite. Have you ever been called a hypocrite? Did you ever call anybody else a hypocrite? Have you ever called anybody and used language like this? Well, now, Jesus could do it because he knew what was in their hearts. He knew them. When you do it, it's because you lash out in anger. When I do it, I lash out in anger. But it's not really always guided by knowledge. Jesus was. He was accurate. But we still don't know what he was doing. We still don't know his nature or his personality until we find out who he was angry with. And that's the important thing I want you to see tonight. Who was he angry with? What in the world was it that caused him to call forth this kind of language and also to make this whip and drive these people out of the temple area? What was it that caused him to do that? First of all, let me make this observation, that the people that he drove out of the temple area and the ones to which he directed this language, they were the same people. The same people. You know who they were? They were church members. That's right. These were religious people. They were religious people. He's not talking to outsiders here. He's talking to those who were on the inside. He was talking to religious leaders. He was talking to those people who would be parallel to our elders, our deacons, our preachers, those who are the servants, those who are the teachers. This is the kind of people he was talking to. This is the kind of people that he drove out of the temple, because he drove the people out of the temple who were part of the machinery. He was talking to people who were a part of the establishment. And when Jesus zeroes in on these people with his whip, and when he zeroes in on them with his words that are so scathing, he's talking to the people who were members of the establishment. And he saw them as being this particular character. He saw them as having these particular traits. And it is this that called forth this righteous indignation. And by the way, I suggest that of all the things that we'll study about, this comes nearer to being a lesson that we're going to have to chew up and digest than anything perhaps you'll see in this. We're going to get an indication of what he is like by looking at those people that he was angry at. Who were they? Well, they were the religious leaders first. And he was angry at hypocrisy, religious hypocrisy. I want you to turn to Matthew 23 and let's hurriedly go down through this and notice some of these things and see if you find yourself in any of them. He spoke of the religious leaders first. In chapter 23 and verse 2 and 3, he says, "The scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So practice and observe whatever they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they preach but don't practice." Now these people, he says, they are religious hypocrites. They tell you to do things, but they don't do them themselves. They preach, but they don't practice. They're living opposite of what they're saying. They're void of practice. They're very vocal in their preaching, but void in their practice. But secondly, he says, they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, that is, other men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with their finger. They expected of other people what they didn't require of themselves, or they required of other people what they didn't expect of themselves. You know anybody like that? Do you find yourself perhaps like that sometimes? Do you ever expect of other people what you don't require of yourself? Jesus was talking to people like that here. Thirdly, he says these people do all their deeds to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad. They make their borders broad. They love to sit in the chief seats. They love to the salutations in the synagogues. They like all of these things that lift them up and exalt them before men. He said they really do vibrate to that. They like that. So he talked about them as being people who were religious hypocrites. And on down in verse 25, he says, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they're full of extortion and rapacity. You blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and of the plate, that the outside also may be clean." And he uses this word Pharisee, and he uses the word scribe, but the word that he uses most often to describe the quality or the makeup of these people is the word hypocrite, those who put on a play, those who are behind a mask. They're one way on the inside and some other way on the outside. Now, young people, many times, and notice this, Jesus was locking horns with the establishment. Jesus was seeing in the establishment hypocrisies. He was seeing in them inequities. He was seeing in them inconsistencies. And these inconsistencies were very outstanding. Many times, you look at the establishment, you see things that you think are hypocrisies also, and you find yourself more or less standing in the same position that Jesus did as he looked into the hearts of these people and saw the inequities and hypocrisies that were perpetrated by these people here. The only difference between you and the Lord is that he could make an accurate judgment. You can't. So be very kind and merciful and be very cautious. Be swift to hear and slow to speak in your judgments about the establishment or about the church. But nevertheless, Jesus was seeing perhaps some of the same things that you see in your home congregations, in this congregation, and in any congregation of the Lord as you look at the establishment. Jesus was angry at religious hypocrisy. But secondly, he was angry at those religious leaders who were blindly reducing religion to mockery. And it had to do with every aspect of life. For example, he says in verse 16, "Woe to you blind guides who say, if anyone swears by the temple, it's nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. You blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it's nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that's on the altar, he's bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? So he who swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and him that dwells in it. And he who swears by by heaven swears by him who by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it." So you find him taking them to task for this silly, childish, juvenile way of conducting their human relations. They were more or less saying, "Oh, I said that, but my fingers were crossed." Did you ever say that? Children say that sort of thing. And these religious people, you know, you had to know the code in order to get along with these religious folks. You had to know how to play the game, and the rules of the game they made up as they went along. They would say, I swear by the temple that I'll give you this money. Oh, okay. And that was a fellow, you know, who was from out of town. He didn't know any different. He didn't know that the Jerusalem rules were different from what they were in Galilee. in Jerusalem, the rules of the game was that when you swear by the temple, it really didn't make any difference. But swear by the gold of the temple, oh, that's binding there. And so the fellow just got ripped off for about $5 or $10 or $15 because he didn't swear by the gold of the temple. Jesus said, you blind fool. Don't you know that the gold of the temple is only worthwhile because the temple is that which sanctifies the gold? Which is more important? The little everyday things of life, they were ripping people off in this hypocrisy that they were guilty of. But not just little things like that. They were talking about also things that were earth-shaking, things that were so momentous, things that were so absolutely monumental, such things as love and justice and mercy. He said, you're sitting over there picking up seeds and tithing mint, anise, and cumin, and you're overlooking the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and love, or justice, mercy, and faith. And he talked about how they were ignoring the great weighty matters of the law while they were taking care of these silly incidentals. And he said, you ought not to leave either one undone. You ought to have done this and not left the other undone. But that doesn't even tell the full story there. These people that Jesus was angry at were those people who were actually circumventing the very will of God and were actually trampling underfoot their own mothers and fathers. In the book of Mark, Jesus tells the story about how he said, you have a real fine way, he says, of ignoring or circumventing or going contrary to the will of God. He says you have a real good way of holding on to your traditions. For example, he says, the law says, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of father and mother shall die the death. But he said, you say that if any man says to his mother or father, well, that which by which you would have been benefited from me, it's been given to God. It's Corban. And he says, you don't then allow that person to help his mother and father. You allow him to get out from under that responsibility. And you allow that old mother and father, the mother that bore him and the father that cared for him and raised him, they allowed them to let those people die in poverty by saying, well, what you would have been benefited from me is given to God. That's why he was angry at them. But something else, look, a third reason. These people who were guilty of religious stumbling blockery, that's a new word and I want to coin it. Religious stumbling blockery. It's found in the book here in verse 13 of chapter 23. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. They were causing a stumbling block to other people. And then fourthly, these people were guilty of sectarian zeal. He says in verse 15, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you traverse sea and land to make a single proselyte. And when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves. My goodness alive. What on earth was it that caused him to be so scathing in his denunciation of these people? He was tangling, yes, with the establishment. He was tangling with the religious leaders of his day. He was chiding and was rebuking and was scathingly denouncing those people who were religious people. This is a lesson to us. He's talking to religious people. Now, you may not be able to get a handle on any of that. It may be more or less elusive. But here's something you can get a handle on, and we'll give you the key to this whole concept. As we look at Jesus Christ, here's how you can determine what this man's anger was centered upon. Jesus became angry whenever God was deprived of his glory and whenever people were deprived of their needs. That's what made Jesus angry. You remember on the occasion when he was casting out demons and the Pharisees said, oh, he's casting out demons by Beelzebul, the prince of demons. Jesus said, just a minute, one moment. He said, you can talk about me all day long. And anything that you say about me will be forgiven. But anybody that speaks a word against the Spirit of my Father, it won't be forgiven him in this life or in the world to come. And I suspect they got the impression, uh-oh, you better lay off of that. He gets real uptight when you talk about his Father or the Spirit of his Father. And do you remember the woman that was bent over double for 18 years? I think she was from Capernaum. I'm not sure, but she was in the synagogue. I believe it was Capernaum. She was bent over 18 years long. She'd been bent double. Jesus, they saw him, and they saw her, and they watched him to see whether he would release her. It was the Sabbath day. And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, asked them this question. He said, which of you, having an ox or an ass, won't loose him on the Sabbath day and lead him away to water? And then he said, should not this woman, who is a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound low these 18 years, to have been loosed on the Sabbath day? And it says all of his adversaries were put to shame. I should think so. And then he reached down in gentleness and tenderness and lifted her up and released her and let her stand up straight for the first time in 18 years. Can you imagine? I bet she stretched and carried on and Yes, sir. Listen to this. Jesus was angry only when God's honor was deprived him and when people's needs were deprived them. Jesus never once, and I've checked his life from beginning to end, he never once retaliated when someone did something to him. Never. No, that's where we get mad at that. We don't really get all that mad when God has denied his glory or his honor. We don't really get mad when people around us are deprived of their needs. You know when we get mad? We get mad when we're deprived of our needs, when we're hurt, when we're insulted, when we're slighted. That's when we strike back. Not this man. It's just the opposite with him. It was only when other people's needs were deprived and when God was deprived of his honor that Jesus got mad, and he never once in his entire life that we have any record of showed any retaliatory spirit toward those people who would abuse him. Never once. When he was crucified on the cross, he asked his Father, forgive these men. They don't know what they're doing. The nearest thing that he came to retaliation was when he stood before Pilate. And it may or may before, it was in his trial. It's found in John, the 18th chapter. At his trial, he was before the high priest. And he answered the high priest with a word of judgment and wisdom and soberness. And somebody slapped him. And they said, do you speak to the high priest like that? And Jesus then on that occasion said, if I have done wrongly, bear witness to the wrong. But if I have not, why do you slap me? And that's all he said. Jesus is angry here in John 2. He's angry when he drove those people out of the temple. But if you look at either, it's not the parallel passage, perhaps it's another event of his cleaning the temple. There's a bit of undecidedness here about whether this was two events or not. But in Matthew 21, when he drove the people out of the temple there, he said, my Father's house should be called a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of robbers. And there he makes reference to both of these relationships. It was supposed to be a den, it was supposed to be a house of praise and prayer to God. And yet they were depriving God of that. And it was supposed to be a place where people were served, and yet they had turned it into a place to exploit people. He says, you're not going to do that. Get out of here. I'm not going to tolerate such abuse of people and such ignoring of the glory that belongs to God. You're not going to act like that. So he drove them out. Now, there are some implications that I want to draw as we conclude. These implications are these. He's talking, as I've already observed, he's talking to religious people here. Let's leave that for just a moment. Let's make this the first implication that we draw. You can't stand for right without standing against wrong. Young people, this is something I think this generation needs to learn. And I guess I needed to learn it too when I was your age. I found it terribly difficult to criticize those people that were my peers. I found that almost, you know, anything they did was all right. You know, don't criticize them. But I'll tell you one thing. The conflict between Jesus and these people who were his religious peers, in a sense, the conflict was inevitable. It had to come. The showdown was just had to come. And the conflict between you and the people in the world who are your peers, who are your own people, your own age and all in the world, that showdown's got to come too. The time's going to have to come when you come to the place, you draw the line, and you say, I've listened to music a lot in my life, but that's the filthiest thing I've ever heard, and I'll not listen to a word of it, and you turn that radio off. The time's going to have to come when you say, I've worn a lot of clothes in my life, but that's the filthiest, nastiest thing I've ever seen, and I'm not going to wear it. I don't care if everybody else in the world is wearing it. I'm not going to be caught dead in that outfit. The time's going to come when you're going to have to make that decision. You can't stand for right without standing up sometimes for wrong or against wrong and letting it be known that you're against wrong. But a second thing, it means that morality and truth are not relatives. They're concrete. They're not relative. They're absolute. You know, the fact that nobody else in all of Jerusalem, all 500,000 or so of those Jewish males, the fact that they didn't see this abuse or didn't do anything about it or couldn't do anything about it, that didn't mean that it was all right. Suppose perhaps it was 5,000 or 500,000 or whatever be to one. 500,000 men to one man. Did that mean that Jesus was wrong? No. It just means that whereas they didn't see it, Jesus did see it. Or whereas they didn't care about it, Jesus did care about it. Or whereas they couldn't do anything about it, Jesus could and did do something about it. That's all it means. And so does it mean today. It may mean that you're the only people as followers of Jesus Christ who are willing to stand up and say, I don't care what the world says, this is wrong. And I'm here to let you know right now, tonight, that I'm not going to be caught dead doing that. That's your responsibility. And the fact that the entire world is saying, oh, well, it doesn't really make any difference. It's neither right nor wrong. Homosexuality is neither right nor wrong. Don't call it a perversion. Just call it a difference. Don't call anything right or wrong. The time is going to have to come when you say, look, you're sick. You're sick, and I'll have no part of it. Morality is not relative. It's concrete. It's absolute. But then there's a third thing. Jesus here becomes the standard. Otherwise, you don't have any standard. He's the way and the truth and the life. And those of us who follow Jesus Christ are setting him up as the standard of our conduct and as the standard of our judgments. And if we don't accept his standard of judgment as being what's right, we don't have any standard of judgment. And if we don't accept his standard for what's right or wrong, we don't have any standard to know how to conduct our lives either. But again, Jesus opposes any religion that would set itself up as a temple keeper while at the same time being void of the Spirit of God. Now that's what he's confronting here. He was after the temple keepers here. Do you know how close that strikes home to us? Do you know how close it strikes home to those of us who are members of the Restoration Movement, who are part of that Restoration Movement in America, and wherever the Restoration Movement is, all over the world? Do you know how easy it is for us to insist on forms while the Spirit of God may be far away from us? Are you aware of that? Sometimes how guilty we are of tithing men, annis, and cumin, and seeing to it that all the forms and that all the outer structure and that all the qualifications and everything are just so, and we make such a bold proclamation that all this has to be, while all along we're just as void many times of the Spirit of God as these people here were. Jesus is talking to that situation. And I find it's one of the most sobering things in all the Bible to see Jesus Christ as he comes into his Father's temple and begins to take charge and cast these people out. Who were they? They were people who were claiming to be temple keepers. And yet they were void of the Spirit of God. Let's be careful. Let's be careful. It's so easy to begin straining at gnats and swallowing camels. Jesus says you need to do both. You need to strain out the gnats and you also need to strain out the camels. But let's not strain out one and swallow the other. Well, finally, more than what I've said there about the temple, perhaps, we need to recognize that we ourselves are temples of God. This is what you read in Ephesians 2. We're built together as a temple, but individually we're temples. And you see, what we're for as Christians, what we're for, our temple, our body, is really to be an organism in which and out of which grows praise to God, and out of which flows service to fellow man, you see. Our temple is supposed to be what Jesus said the temple of God was in Jerusalem. He said, my Father's house is supposed to be a house of prayer and praise, but you've made it a den of robbers. Our temple of God, in which he dwells, it also is supposed to be a temple of praise. That's why we're Christians. And it's also supposed to be a place of where we do service to humanity. I wonder what Jesus thinks as he comes into the precincts of our temple, into the precincts of our heart. And as he walks along in the precincts and looks around in the temple of our hearts and our minds and our wills, and as he sees these temples that he created in order to be a place of praise and an instrument of service, I wonder what he sees in those temples. I wonder if he sees the table of money changers where we sit there and make plans on how to rip people off. I wonder if he sees us as people who don't pay their debts, you know, and if you can get by without paying something, well, man, get by with it. Go to law. I wonder if he sees us as people who exploit other people and who, instead of praising God, are a disgrace to God. What does he see when he looks into your heart and into your temple, into the precincts of your own temple? He's going to come one day and clean you. He's going to look into your heart. And he's going to look. In fact, he already is. He knows you. This thing closes by saying he knew what was in every man. He knows what's in your heart right now. If he were to walk into your heart literally right now and look into you and lay yourself open, what would he find? Money changers? People selling oxen and sheep and doves? Ripping people off? Or would he find someone who was praising God and serving people? This is what made Christ angry. When he found people depriving God of his honor and depriving fellow man of their needs, this set him on this warfare. And we get an insight into the judgment when we see him. All right, let's look at this part of the Lord's life. Let's apply it to our lives. And let's remember that he's talking here to church members. He's talking to religious people. Then let's do a job of cleaning up ourselves. And let's let the Lord come in and repaint, remake, break down, remold, shape, do whatever he wants to. Just say, Lord, come on in, take over. clean me out. I'm ready. I'm yours. This lesson is primarily to those of us who are Christians. If you need to make some correction, if your temple hadn't been what it ought to be, if it's public and you've been publicly doing things that are not right, then come back home now. Whatever may be your need, will you encourage each other while we stand together and sing?